Will they or won't they? And if they do, when will it happen? Maine lawmakers left town last month with a lot of work left to be done. I'm Mal Leary, senior political reporter for Maine Public Radio. Today, my guests are the legislature's two top leaders who will answer the question, what's next for the legislature? Will there be Medicaid expansion? Will there be changes in the minimum wage? And will a borrowing package of upwards of $200 million for road and bridge repairs and University of Maine system improvements go to the voters for their approval? We want to hear from you. How would you rate the legislature? How about your legislator's performance this session? Which unfinished matters are of greatest concern to you? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news update. From the Maine Public Radio studios in Augusta, I'm Mal Leary, and this is Maine Calling. Leaders of the Maine legislature are polling their members about returning to the Capitol for a special session, possibly next Tuesday. I have two of the leaders of the Maine legislature with me to explain where things currently stand on work still left to be done. Sarah Gideon is Speaker of the Maine House and a Democrat from Freeport. Mike Thibodeau is President of the Maine Senate and a Republican from Winterport. Sarah and Mike, welcome back to Maine Calling.
Mal, it's always great to be on with you.
Thanks for having us.
We want to hear from you. What questions do you have for my guest today? Our phone number is 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Let's talk first about polling the legislature to come back into session. This is an ongoing process, but do you have a sense that you will get the votes since House Republicans failed to give you enough votes to extend when the legislature adjourned kind of, shall we say, abruptly?
That's correct, Mal. So as we all know and remember, the reason why we were not able to finish our work back in April and the beginning of May was that House Republicans decided that they did not want to extend our session. We are now in a position, fortunately, where through conversations, it's been indicated to us that House Republicans are amenable to coming back. The poll is officially out, as you mentioned, and we do expect that we will have the numbers to return for special session next week.
Mike, what's the numbers coming in the Senate side?
Well, I don't think that I'll be surprised if there are any votes to not come back in on the Senate side. As everybody I've talked to has been very anxious to get back, finish our work. You know, the good news is we've gotten a lot of work done in the meantime. A lot of folks have been able to get together, have some serious conversations. We've got hopefully a spending package that will receive near unanimous approval in the legislature. I think that, you know, between that and an agreement on tax conformity, we've been working. There's been a lot of work done, and hopefully we can get in a matter of 2 or 3 days, complete our work, and then schedule a veto day and get back and back to doing other things other than the legislature in July.
This is one of those arcane processes that you tell people outside this building, they kind of look at you. You need to get a majority of each of the four partisan caucuses in order to call yourselves back in.
No, the way it works, Mel, is that it has to be a majority of each party in the legislature, and that's how it reads. So what we'll do, the Secretary of the Senate is polling the Senate members. Clerk of the House will poll the House members, and then the Speaker and I will get together. She'll share with me the totals from the House on the Republican side. I'll share with her the totals of the Democrats in the Senate. And as long as 51%, 50 plus one, of both parties agree, then we'll be coming back in. Oh, don't forget, we've got a Green, and, you know, all things hang in the balance. If the Green says no, we're going to have to, you know, reset and figure that out. Madam Speaker, have you found, has the Green voted yet?
So I've had a conversation with our member Representative Chapman of the Green Party and let him know about all the agreements that are in place, and I believe he will be voting yes today, but we'll have to make sure that is so.
You started to talk about what there has been agreement on so far. That's two spending bills coming out of the Appropriations Committee. But that's like a fraction of the bills that you have before you. I remember talking with Senator Hamper, the co-chair of Appropriations, and said, boy, you've got scores of bills. He says, no, there's more than scores. There's over 100. And he says, on top of that, we got all the bills that are in the legislature itself that haven't come down to the Appropriations Committee. So what are you going to do when you come back in session, which I believe is going to be on Tuesday? I mean, are we going to see kind of like a resumption of where we were because you have so many bills in process that were, what, left in limbo when you adjourned?
Yes. Well, so let's try to break this down into a manageable way to digest it. First of all, let's remember that any time that we are looking at bills that cost money, we go through an appropriations process. And there are so many good ideas out there in terms of bills. There are so many needs out there. But we have a limited amount of money, and we need to create a budget and decide and prioritize which items we're going to address immediately. That's what we've done with these two spending packages. In terms of the rest of the bills that are out there on the appropriations table, we expect the appropriations members to come in early next week and begin working through those bills one by one. They'll be looking at those bills on their individual merit, and then the legislature will have to decide as a whole how they want to deal with them. But for now, I think the really good news, which President Thibodeau mentioned, is that we do have agreement based on what we know are the greatest needs, challenges, or opportunities in front of Maine people right now. And those are agreed upon in a spending package that had unanimous support from the Appropriations Committee.
Do you foresee more compromises, more unanimity on some legislation, or are the spending bills where we're going to see it unanimous, and now we're going to start seeing breakdowns, not necessarily on partisan lines, on some bills?
Right. Well, I think that you're going to find that, I mean, there's a whole bunch of bills that are out there that have nothing to do with spending mail that, you know, are going to be debated in the chambers, and, you know, whether they make it through the chambers and down to the governor's desk or not. We're gonna run that process. We were able to come to an agreement before we adjourned sine die to carry them bills forward. We passed an order to do exactly that. And so we'll just be picking up where we left off and running the bills and hopefully getting things done. One of the things that you'll find, and the reason that it's really important that we come to an agreement on the spending side, is that you know, the chief executive has the opportunity to line item things. So we want to get all that spending stuff to him as quickly as possible so that we're here, because he has 24 hours to line item something. And if we pass that on the third day, that means we'd have to come in for a fourth day. So we're going to try to get that down to him very quickly. And then hopefully he'll see some merit in it, and maybe he'll even sign them.
I know this is one of those difficult questions, but from what you're describing, I don't think you're going to get done in a single day, as some people have been talking about. Do you have any idea how many days it will take, discounting veto day, which is what the Senate president was just talking about?
So one thing that we know is we should always expect the unexpected, but we still try to plan as best as we can. Right now, as we look at things, we think that three initial days, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday of next week, should allow us to complete our work. The bills that are still on the table in the House Senate, the bills that are in appropriations, the bonds, which we're driving towards agreement on but are not all the way there yet, we could surprise ourselves and be done in 2 days, but it will likely take three, and then we know that we will most likely be returning for a veto day someday in the future, assuming that the governor vetoes some of the work that we do.
We've got a lot of calls stacked up now from questions from folks all over the state. Let's go to Connie in Farmingdale, who has a specific question on one bill. Connie, go ahead. Here we go. Connie, go ahead.
Hi, I'm sorry. My question is why LD 967 has not passed, and why it had to be combined with another bill instead of going through solely like it was originally intended. So that, in fact, made the Republicans and Democrats butt heads. So people who need these services to live their daily lives for the people who care for them daily. So this hasn't been passed yet, and I understand it takes like 10 days before it's totally passed through. So that means if this doesn't go through by the 20th, then there will be people whose services will not be paid for, and those of us who provide care for these people on a daily basis will get a 12% pay cut. How is that justifiable, and why do you people try to combine bills when it should be a standalone bill?
Madam Speaker.
Connie, thank you for your message. I think you and I might have even communicated via email exchanges. So first of all, I think the most important thing here is for all listeners to understand what Connie's referring to are is a bill aimed at increasing reimbursement rates for direct care workers who will see their actual wages rolled back if we do not make sure that this legislation is passed and passed in a timely manner. I think that both, both parties, Republicans and Democrats, absolutely agree that this is an emergency situation. That is why that is probably the first bill that we will run when we come in on Tuesday, next Tuesday, the 19th. What we hope is that if the governor is going to veto that bill, that he will do so immediately so that we can act on that veto immediately and make sure that it becomes law as soon as possible. So we absolutely recognize that it's an emergency and that the direct care worker bills, as well as allocation for jails, making sure that the jails can continue to function, are our absolute emergency priorities.
Senator, why are you combining different bills into these two spending bills?
Sure.
People don't understand that outside of the process here.
Well, in any budget, particularly if you look at your budget at home, you don't deal with everything in a silo. And, the fact of the matter is direct care workers, the Speaker and I talked about that when we created a budget 2 years ago, that we absolutely both committed to making sure that this was funded. It has never been a question of whether or not we would fund it. It was just a matter of getting the votes and getting it on the floor. And we're in a place now where we can do exactly that. But that's why budget bills come up as packages, because you have to. You only have a finite resource, and there are a lot of obviously a lot of places that or demands on that resource, and you're trying to negotiate what is hopefully the fairest and best package. But make no mistake, the Speaker, myself, and nearly every member of the legislature have been committed to these direct care workers funding, and this was going to happen one way or another, and I'm pleased that we're in a place where we're going to get it passed now.
You're listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio. We want to hear from you with your questions for the two top leaders of the legislature. Our phone number is 1-800-399-3566. You can also send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Let's go to Pam in Falmouth, who has a question that's on a lot of people's minds. Well, I'm trying to get... There we go. Pam?
Okay, great. Thank you for taking my call. Yes, this is on my mind. There's been a lot of rancor here in, say, southern Maine, in some of the school districts, about the burden of local schools more and more on taxpayers. We're looking at 4% increases, 5% increases, 10% increases over in Cape Elizabeth. Where does this end? What I understand that the state of Maine is supposed to meet 55% of the local school budgets, or however the verbiage is on that, and you certainly are not. And on top of that, you're cutting back, which it becomes very expensive for seniors, let's say, on limited or incomes. What are you doing about that? I think that's like number one in addition to health care and maybe infrastructure. It seems to me like you just keep putting it off, putting more and more mandates on local schools that aren't funded. The system is terribly broken, and you're creating so much rancor in southern Maine. I know you all think we're rich down here, but honest to God, it's throughout the state. It's just a mess, and I think you are derelict in not addressing this. Thank you.
Senator.
Well, Pam, I appreciate the phone call, and I'd suggest to you that, you know, I'm very proud of the work that the 128th Legislature did. We actually invested over $150 million new dollars in K-12 education, most of that money in year number two, a significant increase in public education and our support for it. And, you know, look, educating our children is important. It's an expensive proposition, and it does have a substantial impact on people's property taxes. But we are and have made the largest investment in K-12 education as a state in our history. I think we all ought to be proud of that.
Madam Speaker, folks still are very upset that there's not enough money going in to actually meet the needs. So how do you address getting to the 55%, which is in state law, which the legislature exempts from every single session in the budget?
Listen, this is one of the greatest challenges that we have had year after year. And as we all remember, in 2017, it was absolutely our greatest challenge. It was a threat to keeping state government running. And in fact, we closed state government, you know, around this very issue. As the Senate president mentioned, we had our single largest increase in investment in public education in a system where we spend $2 billion of a $7 billion budget on public education in the state of Maine. We added another over $160 million, Mike, that we added last year. I think how we get to 55% is a phenomenal challenge for us, because the price of education is rising at the same time every year that we are trying to keep up with moving towards that goal. Two things that we have in front of us right now that we're going to return to when we get back to work are, one, a bill looking at special education cost drivers and trying to get a greater handle on what's happening with that and how that is driving the cost of education up. And two, we are looking at not only the allocation of those education dollars that we appropriated last year, but we are additionally looking at how we can sweep some money from another account to lower and mitigate the impact in some of the communities that Pam just mentioned. Falmouth and Cape Elizabeth are among two of the many communities that are experiencing challenges this year, even with that $162 million investment in education.
We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, your comments and questions. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Lamy Wellahan Shoes, helping people in Maine communities through their shoe donation program, gathering and distributing gently worn shoes for Mainers in need, and the Maine Association of Nonprofits, uniting and strengthening the nonprofit sector through management training and advocacy. NonprofitMaine.org.
Central Americans seeking U.S. asylum are not being allowed to cross the southern border.
What we're seeing on the ground is that people are being turned away, and they're being told that either there's no room or they cannot enter the port.
I'm Audie Cornish. We'll follow one family who says they were terrorized by gangs in Guatemala and then turned away at a U.S. port of entry. On the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered is every weekday afternoon from 4 to 6:30 here on Maine Public Radio. Maine Public Radio strives to bring you news, information, and public affairs to provide a better understanding of ideas, events, and cultures around the world. The BBC has been a valued addition to our schedule in recent years, adding a comprehensive and global perspective to our news mix. The BBC World Service explores important issues and learns what the world is thinking, saying, and doing. You can hear the BBC World Service overnight from midnight to 6 a.m. on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Mal Leary. Today on the program, finishing up the business before the legislature. With me are Senate President Mike Thibodeau and House Speaker Sarah Gideon. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Or send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We have a lot of questions about school funding, so we're going to go to Bob at Chebaig Island, who has a question on school funding. Bob?
Yeah, Maine is rapidly heading the same way that other states, particularly New Jersey, by funding its schools, at least the majority of the funding coming from property taxes. No matter how much money you try and put into it under the current system, you're not going to keep up with those increases. The $160 million that you funded for additional school aid this year, you know, it doesn't mitigate the 10% increase in Cape Elizabeth or the other increases around the state. You've got to find an alternate mechanism of school funding, or else what's going to happen is the same thing that's happened in New Jersey, where older people and low-income people are driven out of the state. And Maine's population is low now, so, you know, I don't think you want to risk that. You're going to have to look at this very carefully and come up with something that works.
This is more long-term than the special session, but what's your response to that, Madam Speaker?
So, hi, Bob. First, I think I absolutely want to acknowledge that the property taxes are a major burden on Maine people. This is something, actually, that the Senate President and I talk about a lot and has been the focus even of most recent conversations around taxation and tax conformity. First of all, I think absolutely feel that we need to do something to mitigate property tax burden. It is really something that is extremely difficult for Maine people, but especially in a state with a large aging population as we have here. One of the things that we have preliminarily agreed upon, but the entire legislature will need to agree on it, is an increase in the property tax fairness credit, which will be aimed very specifically at lower income, but also seniors. So we recognize this problem for sure. I think in terms of the long-term way that we pay for education, and again, that we look at the increasing cost of education, we do need to get a handle on that. It's one of the things that we struggle with the most. We are very open to ideas. What I do think is that as we are investing more than $2 billion of a $7 billion budget, from Maine in public education, that we're definitely demonstrating our commitment to it. Now we just have to figure out how we make sure that the state is paying its fair share and that the burden is not falling on property taxpayers in a way that they just can't keep up with.
Senator?
Sure. I mean, this is a discussion that goes on, you know, and will continue far beyond the 128th legislature. But we have made significant investments. Very proud of the fact that as part of the tax conformity package, we're again adding another $10 million to that property tax fairness credit. As the speaker said, you know, really targeting towards Maine's elderly population, trying to make sure that folks that in desperate situations can stay in their homes. But it is a you know, a big nut to crack. You know, there has to be a local aspect to paying for schools because the decisions are at the local level. And, you know, so I'm sure that it will be debated long after the 128th finishes up its work here next week.
You briefly mentioned bonds when we started the program. When you look at the whole bonding question, we've got a question here from Lewis in Augusta, wants to know why the governor even has a role in the bonding process. Lewis, what's your question, please?
If we look at the Maine State Constitution, there is no role for the governor, and there shouldn't be because you need two-thirds majority already. And then the legislature, for some very odd reason, sticks in the words that the treasurer has to issue them at the direction of the governor. And as we've seen, this governor has abused that authority, which he should never have in the first place. So I'm asking why you put that in when it is no role under the Maine State Constitution in the bonding process.
Senator, you want to tackle that one?
So, Mal, thanks. And, you know, obviously, Lewis has spent some time looking into this, and, you know, that wasn't a decision that was made in the 128th legislature. That has been the way things have been done for a very, very long time in this state, that the, you know, the administration has to sign off on the selling of bonds. And, you know, I mean, there's a two-thirds process. These are bills. They're, you know, when a bill becomes comes through the legislature, you know, the executive branch has to sign bills or veto them. It can become law without their buy-in, but you know, these are bills, and you know, the administration has an opportunity to weigh in.
Isn't the whole bonding process, like everything else in this building, political? Don't you need support from whoever the governor is to get the votes to pass a bond, since it does take two-thirds?
I mean, it is political, yes. Look, when we agree on bonds, when we agree to pass them with two-thirds, we need the support of each other. We spend a lot of time trying to convince each other which bonds earn the greatest merit. And I think, unfortunately, what we've seen, and Lewis, just to address, you know, your question here a little bit too, is there has been a much greater political process around bonding. I think that this governor particularly has used the bond process and what would normally be just a signature along the way to state what he wants to happen policy-wise and politics-wise. And we've seen seniors, for example, really suffer for it. When the senior bonds, you know, were not released, all of these shovel-ready projects for low-income seniors who desperately need housing have been stalled and waiting there despite the intentions of the legislature. So I hope that we find governors in the future who are you know, recognizing that the legislature is a separate but equal branch of government as we pass bonds and send them to the voters, and as the voters pass them and expect the money to be released.
Let's talk about bonds for a minute, because that's one of the big issues you have remaining when you come back next week. The last time I looked, it's like $1 billion worth of proposals sitting on the table. From what I've heard from the Appropriations Committee, they're looking at maybe around $175 million. So how do you winnow down those requests? I mean, obviously, the big one we're hearing about is for road and bridges, $100 million. But there are a lot of other proposals that sound to most folks to have a lot of merit. Senator, you want to start with that?
Sure. You know, I think that there is general agreement that we're going to do a transportation bond that will be $100 million. And, you know, most everybody realizes that our infrastructure is in desperate need of that infusion of cash to make sure that, you know, the roads we drive on are safe. There's been a lot of talk around a wastewater bond, because that has, again, that's part of our infrastructure, and that has been falling behind rather than coming ahead. So investments in them sort of things, higher education, talking about that, trying to make sure that, you know, we have some of the best facilities and the best places for any student to go and to get a terrific education. The list is endless of really great ideas with a finite resource. You know, when we bond something, you have to have debt service. And the next budget that comes out will have to have significant debt service budgeted in. That means that, you know, that money isn't available to do other things. So, bonds is borrowing, and sometimes people miss that, that money has to be paid back. And so we try to prioritize and spend that them resources wisely.
So when you look at the whole bond, the process of coming up with those, you look at some of these and you go, well, these both have importance for the particular area. University of Maine system wants a capital bond, but at the same time, several lawmakers and the governor are saying the high cost of higher education, there should be some bonding proposal to try to mitigate that cost. They both sound to be very good, but I'm not sure you can afford both with the amount of money that's available.
Yes. So, as always, there is a limited amount of money available. Look, you know, when we think about bonds, what we need to be thinking about is how can we use this process to make investments that will actually move Maine forward. I think that one of the greatest challenges that we've had through this administration, the administration of Paul LePage, is that we've become far too reliant on bonding for transportation, for example. We should be looking at how we can fund that through other ways, as well as maybe some bonding. But because we spend such a large chunk on transportation bonding, we're completely ignoring, for example, needs like infrastructure, broadband infrastructure, where we could be really generating some real movement in the economy when we use bonding in that way. Here we are, though. As Senate President Thibodeau said, we do have some general agreement around the ideas of making sure that we're investing in higher education. This is incredibly important. As we know, we really have a challenge with making sure that we keep Maine as a place that young people want to come to or stay. And if we do not have a competitive university system, if we do not have state-of-the-art facilities available for people to come learn in, why would they stay here to do that? So these are some of the focuses that we have.
And Mel, I kind of just jump in. To pretend that by us bonding and making resources available to upgrade and maintain facilities at the university, we can't pretend that that doesn't have a direct impact on tuition. It helps to lower the cost of tuition to every student that attends the university system. And I see that as a great thing. Our university has been able to be very price competitive and attract significant numbers of young people from other states all across our country. And many of these young people are coming here to Maine, and they're making a conscious decision to stay and raise a family, which is terrific too.
We've got a lot of education and education-related questions. Let's go to Tom in Bath, who has a question about the teacher pension system. Tom, go ahead with your question.
Thank you for taking my call, and thank you both for your service to the state of Maine. The teacher's pension has been rated in the past, and every year it gets considered and does not get reimbursed. And I'm wondering when the legislature is going to make good on the contract that they made and replace those funds to that pension that was raided. Thank you.
Who wants to take that one first?
So I guess I'll take a stab at it. And I wish I could remember the date, but it's like 2027, something like that, is when the final payments will be made to that fund. It is on a schedule to be repaid. The way I remember it, and you know, we're working at it.
So we're working at it. Is the
I wish I could remember. No, yeah, but Mel, I mean, it isn't like it's an ignored issue. We have dealt with it. It's on a payment schedule. We're doing exactly what we should, which is putting that back.
Let's go to Gene in Waldoboro, who has another education-related question. Gene, go ahead. What's your question, please?
Yes. I remember when the state was talking about selling the lottery to us. And the big selling point was all the money that was going to go to education. And I think that was the major push on that. And I just wonder why we have such a problem with funding education in Maine, when it appears, I don't play it, so I don't know a lot about it, it appears that there's a lot of money that is not going to education. I'd just like to know what is happening with that money. Has it ever gone to education, and how it's dispersed? Is it earmarked for education, or does it go to the towns for in their general fund? Just how it's used. Thank you.
Thank you, Gene. What really happened on that was it was sold as going to education, but there was no statute language that said the money had to go to education. But this issue keeps coming up, folks, over the years when people point back and say, we voted for the lottery. on the basis that it was going to go to education, but it's never gone to education. It's gone into the state general fund. Has there been any discussion of dedicating part of that money to education, if not all of it?
Mel, I wish I knew the exact dollar figure that is generated from the lottery, but I'll assure you that we are investing significantly more than what's generated in, you know, through the lottery. You know, that's a very small portion of the total dollar investment that we're making in public education.
We're going to take another quick break, but before we do, a word about tomorrow's show. Join host Jennifer Rooks in the Main calling gardening experts for answers to your planting, pruning, and picking questions. You're listening to Main Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Maine Masonic Charitable Foundation, supporting Maine Public Radio's efforts to provide knowledge, wisdom, and entertainment to the people of Maine. And Houston & Company, designers and builders of custom fine furniture, with a showroom and workshop in Kennebunkport, and online at houstonandcompany.com.
On the next Fresh Air, we listen back to interviews with feminist Jill Kerr Conway, the first woman president of Smith College. She died this month. Her three acclaimed memoirs include The Road from Kurrain, about growing up on an Australian sheep farm where she learned women could do the same work as men. She said sex role stereotyping has hurt men as much as women. Join us.
Fresh Air is tonight at 7 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio. Stay with us at 2 o'clock for World Affairs. Today it's a panel discussion called Restoring Dignity, the Case of the Rohingya. That's coming up in about 20 minutes at 2 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Mal Leary, and you're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, Unfinished Business at the Maine Legislature. Joining me, Sarah Gideon, Speaker of the Maine House, and Mike Thibodeau, President of the Maine Senate. Join our conversation. Give us a call. Our number is 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Let's go to a question from Lawton, who's in Penobscot. Lawton, what's your question for the two leaders?
I was wondering, kind of looking down the road, what the Senate and the House of Representatives is doing around civil discourse. And I know that they're hooked in with the, the National Civil Discourse Institute. Is it Matthew Poulton, Representative Poulton?
Representative Poulton.
86, yeah. And I think maybe Roger Katz, but I'm just wondering if you could each just speak a little about, you know, say we get a governor that's not such a spicy tomcat. You know, what do you see for the future as far as trying to get the parties to work together better?
Speaker Gideon, you've had some moments during this year in debate when discourse was not very civil and you had to calm things down.
Yes. Lawton, first, thank you for your question. It's a really, really important one because it's at the foundation of any of the work that we can do. And I've never heard the term spicy tomcat before, but it's fantastic. So in terms of civil discourse, you correctly identified that a couple of our legislators have worked really hard to bring the National Institute of Civil Discourse here and some of their programs here. And that's something that President Thibodeau and I have both really embraced and participated in as well. We can't do anything if we can't recognize that we have different ideas, different goals, or sometimes the same goals but different ideas about how to get there. And the most important thing that we have to be able to do is to listen, number one, and to understand the other person's point of view, number two. And if we can do those two things, and if we can keep our lines of communication open and be respectful to each other, then I think that there is no task that is insurmountable for us. It's been really an increasingly challenging thing to do. As Mal mentioned, things can sometimes get very, very heated in the course of debate. I think that has become more true, even over the years that I have participated participated in the legislature for 6 years now, and I will tell you that it is absolutely at the top of my list to recommit myself to setting an example to do that, and then encouraging and asking all the people around me, whether it is staff or fellow legislators, to join in and for us to all do it, that together.
Mike, go ahead.
Lawton, I really appreciate the question. You know, the fact of the matter is, before the legislature starts each session, the Speaker of the House and the President of the Senate get to address the incoming members, and it's probably one of the best opportunities that is presented to us. And I always ask one question to the incoming members: do you believe how many people in this room love the state of Maine? And you know, every hand goes up. My next question is, do you believe the person that's sitting next to you, that they love the state of Maine too? The fact of the matter is, we all have very different life experiences, different backgrounds. It's who, them things are what make us who we are. But just because I don't agree with you on a particular issue doesn't mean that I have to hate you. And that isn't just the legislature, that's society as a whole. We all need to step back and think about it just for a minute. We're all Americans. We all love our families. We all want to have a good job and a great place to live. We're not all enemies. And we ought to take just take a deep breath. And the next time you feel like you want to lash out at somebody that disagrees with you, you know, reconsider that action and recognize that, we all do love our state in our nation, and we need to find good in one another. It's a whole lot easier if you find some good in the person that you're negotiating with. It's a whole lot easier to get things done.
We have another question about where we should be investing for the future of the state. Let's go to Carlos in Georgetown. Carlos, what's your question, please?
Yes. My question is, I think that in the current campaign, it felt to me like we've come to a consensus that an adequate broadband infrastructure, or at least certainly one that's not one of the worst in the country, is essential to addressing a lot of the economic and other issues we have in the state and to our future. And what I want to know is, I understand there's an opportunity to fund the current Connect Maine program at a level that is actually going to help projects like the one we're considering in Georgetown, Southport, and Arousic. And I want to know whether or not in this session, before the session ends, whether or not there's an opportunity to actually fund that so we can actually start moving forward on broadband infrastructure now rather than waiting, another year or less or more.
Speaker Gideon.
Yes. So thank you, Carlos, very much for your question. We have been taking, I think, consistent steps towards getting better broadband and broadband in more places in the state of Maine over the past 4 years. And then before that also, where we took a giant step in putting the three-ring binder into place. And yet we're still not getting all the way there. We've made some significant changes to Connect Maine, some of which I think you're talking about here, over the past 2 years, really focusing on making sure that organization is looking at the needs of individual locations in the state of Maine and trying to meet those needs or help the communities actually meet the needs themselves. But we haven't gotten all the way there. We do need to fund it more. Whether that's going to happen this year, I think, is still uncertain. What we also need to do, realistically, knowing the challenges in a state that is as large and rural and sparsely populated in certain areas as Maine is that we're probably going to need to make an investment, not just in the Connect Maine side of things, but also in the actual broadband, and that's probably kind of come through a bonding process with a large amount of money. I think we're just not quite there yet, but I hope that we're going to be there very, very soon, because Maine continues to fall behind other states and become less and less competitive as long as we don't address this.
President Thibodeau, bonding for infrastructure for broadband is one of the bills sitting on the table, so you could do something with it. Is it in the discussions that are underway on a bond package?
Sure. And, you know, I mean, obviously it's a great investment, but, you know, you're competing with highway investment and University of Maine investment, investment in, a whole host of different things. I want to suggest to folks that we're not as bad off as we'd like to think we are. We've got a lot of dark fiber in this state, and that dark fiber is, slowly being lit up by, we've got some terrific companies that are building out, and I wish I could remember the name of the company there. Shirley Manning is the owner, and they do a terrific job in the Mid-Coast, and they are building out fiber at one of the fastest paces you'll find any place in the state. And, so we got a lot of people that are working really hard to bring fiber to homes and businesses all across the state. It is a long process. I don't think that any state feels as though they have, fulfilled what they want. They're still working, and we're no different. But we've got a lot of great assets and a lot of great people that are working hard to build that out, and we don't want to lose sight of that either.
Let's go to Debbie in Bangor, who has a question far more broadly than just next week's session. Debbie, go ahead, please.
Well, one of the things that I think is missing in our communication about what's going on in our state is sort of a vision, sort of a strategic plan to help look at all of the issues that we're facing and, pull in the best and the brightest to identify how we might expand in areas that really would benefit us as a whole. I mean, we are obviously we're bleeding our young people. They're moving away. We have an older population. Education is incredibly expensive, but it is the most important thing we can invest in because it's our future. These are the people who are going to take care of us in our old age. So we have to find a way to touch on all of these issues that really do make a state great. And so what I want to know from each of you is what you are doing, and do you see an opportunity to bring together a group of people that can lend some expertise and assist with the decision-making that's going on in Augusta? I'll hang up and listen.
Thanks, Debbie. Madam Speaker.
Yeah, so Debbie, thank you very much for your question. And it is one of the most challenging and one of the most important things that we do, that we actually look forward in a long-term way with a strategic vision for the state of Maine. I think that where we find ourselves right now is with a lack of that vision. I think one of the things that we most need in an executive branch and that has really been lacking through the administration of Paul LePage are bold ideas and leadership around a vision for Maine, both celebrating what's going right and what natural resources and tools that we have, and then figuring out how do we translate it into the 21st century economy. That means when you have an executive branch working towards that, then they can pull all branches of government together. Then they can also pull together, as you mentioned, leaders from outside of government who can put their heads together. I really hope that whoever it is, Democrat or Republican or independent, our next governor is going to be focused on doing that. And the legislature will absolutely be standing at the ready and waiting and ready to help. In the meantime, we have been working towards actually creating that strategic plan ourselves. The legislature, through the Labor, Commerce, Research, and Economic Development Committee, has been working on long-term strategic goals based on economic goals and making sure that we understand how we use our greatest resource, people, how we use our second greatest resource, our natural resources, and how we look at where this economy is heading, not just in this state, but nationally, and in fact, globally, and making sure that Maine is a part of it.
President Thibodeau, this sounds a lot like what businesses do when they create a strategic plan. Where do we want to be in 5 years? Where do we want to be in 10 years? Where do you want to be for the future of Maine?
Well, I think that's why we have put such an emphasis on investing in public education. I know that it never seems like enough, but the fact of the matter is we have increased that significantly because we do know that our children are our future. I had the pleasure of going to deliver the Secretary of State's Citizenship Award to the eighth grade in Winneport last night, and you know, you see them young people with the big smiles on their faces, and you recognize that our future may be brighter than some of us old gray-haired folks may think. The world is, you know, it looks very different through them young set of eyes, and you know, we've got a lot of folks that are working really hard in public education to make sure that they reach their full potential, and we ought to be proud of that. Look, we can always do a better job, and we always want to be looking towards our future, trying to plan ahead. But that's what a budget does. That's it isn't just the administration's responsibility. It's all of our responsibility to weigh in on that, to you know, to really come together and you know, talk about how we invest, how we move our state forward, and how we make our state the best place in the world to live.
Thank you both for joining us today. Sarah Gideon is the Speaker of the Maine House. Mike Thibodeau is President of the Maine Senate. Writing Nick Poor ran the board today, and we had additional help from John Bradford. You can find past editions of Maine Calling, as well as a link to our audio archives, by visiting mainecalling.org. Today's show will be broadcast again tonight at 8. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, Jennifer Rooks returns with the Maine Calling Gardening Experts. I'm Mal Leary. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.